Welcome to podcast One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings, episode number 22. I'm Andrew Turtis, your host, with my co-host Michael Unterberg. Hello there.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. Welcome. You know, I feel like this topic, we've talked about it actually for the few years we've known each other. And there's no title yet for the topic. I just had a metaphor come to me to even approach it. When I was a kid, through those spinning, not merry-go-rounds, but very miniature at a playground, these metal, what do you call it?
Well, we used to call it a vomit wheel, where they were like handles,
yes,
and the kid would
exactly.
hold the, one kid would get stuck with the job of running it around in a circle.
Right. So it's, I was looking for a more neutral term, but the thing is, if people are already on it and it's going at a speed, there's not quite an access for someone else unless they have an amazing skill and coordination. But there's a speed where someone's just going to, if they try to get on, they're going to fall down. I remember that. Then that, and also kind of the merry-go-round idea. I remember getting onto a moving merry-go-round, but not a high-speed one.
Well, clearly you never lived like I did as a hobo on the rails.
Right. You know, but my...
You've probably never had a bindle on a stick that you carried with you.
No, but my dear friend and my first mentor went out of college, Alan Martin, he did.
For realsies?
He was a hobo. He was for realsies a hobo. Hmm. Bless his soul. So this idea that's coming to me visually is the wheel, the merry-go-round is halacha, is the practice. That's why I didn't want to call it I want to keep a neutral term. So the merry-go-round is spinning, and when it's really spinning, it has its own, it seems totally, it has its own integrity, its own form, shape, direction, and it's, but it's whole, from an outside perspective, from my perspective. Then, when the merry-go-round in between rides, it slows down enough, or even at the playground, it slows down enough so then someone else could get on. People can get on, get off. Once I've gotten on a merry-go-round ride that I really thought I wanted to be on, there's times where it's either gone too fast for me, or at some point it's seemed too slow, or just too much of the same motion.
You didn't
motion.
Get on the up and down horse, you got on the regular.
I have, right. Mm-hmm. That there's something uncomfortable, even just with me being on that. I'm someone who gets motion sick sometimes. But at the same time, so in a way I want some different ride when I'm on there, or to get off the ride, have some different movement. And when I've considered halakha, and I know we've spoken about law and personal practice about 18, 20 episodes ago, in the wee hours of the program. But I want to look at this as halakha in the sense of that place where, for me, it still looks external. It looks to be moving in its own system and complete in a way, but in a way that when I interact, there's definitely certain aspects of halakha that I live in my life, Shabbat practice and kashrut and other things. But that for me, this system which looks closed. I mean, I know there's shaping, using metaphors, not complete. But the
no metaphor is
yeah. But to then to just get into it, I'm going to move away from metaphor and to use a teaching from Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook that Shoshana and I learned when we were in Tzfat with David and Miriam Friedman, maybe 8 years ago or so. I mean, it could have been longer. And they're reading Rav Cook about an exploration about halakha, and that the word shares the root for lalechet, to walk, and holech, walking, and that the idea that there is to be some movement from generation to generation as time went. And I want to kind of open the conversation, keeping in mind, like in my personal experience, where there's something where there's certain things that attract me to the system, certain things that repel me from the system. I mentioned, I think, on last episode that there's some things I'm allergic to the when it's become fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, and you know, you've introduced me to more of Rav Kook's teachings where he, in my understanding, he's very dedicated and very, you know, internally committed, spiritually committed to halakha, to the whole practice, and also always yearning for like the total freedom too. Like there's something, so yeah, he could identify and really appreciate that tension.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you'd speak to these ideas, starting with that maybe the original intent of halakha, and that it was to be developed, or to and how it might still be, and also the idea of what the value of it becoming fixed, or at least written, like the writings of the laws, and how.
Well, I mean, and nothing can ever. No, let's talk about isms for a second before we even get to Judaism. No ism can survive if it's totally fixed, because it'll just become irrelevant and obsolete.
How about prism?
Prism?
A prism. It's an ism that seems.
That is. Oh, I wasn't thinking. I was. Oh. You got me. I guess also like alcoholism. I was referring more to like, you know, movements. You nailed me on the prism. Dang it. But in whatever your cultural movement is, if it becomes ossified, if it becomes fossilized, if it becomes frozen, then it loses relevance in real life, and it will die. If it's so free flowing that it's in constant only with no continuity, well, then you don't have a movement. Because it can't survive over time. You can have a wonderful movement, a contemporary movement, but it won't. You have this horizontal. You could have a very big, widespread movement, but vertically, it won't transmit over time to further generations. And there are a lot of movements like that, and that's part of how society and the world works. If you take, let's say, the beatnik movement in the 50s that evolved to the hippie movement and certain aspects of it, but they're kind of different movements. And I would argue that the hippie movement itself didn't really survive in the form that it was. That as that generation grew older, elements of it, which of course are elements, whether caring for social justice, pacifism, a certain amount of hedonism, these are always undercurrents in society, but that particular framework of the hippie has become historical, even though elements of it are constant in human nature and in the development of any society. So there's no such thing as an ism, movement-wise, not glass,
right, right.
But that is either totally static or totally malleable. You're only talking about how much of each? What's the ratio? And there may not really be a quantifiable ratio. And what probably is that different people will relate to it at different points on a spectrum of static to malleable. And that every movement, every ism, has members who approach it somewhat differently. Now, if you're asking in big picture, there's no question that what we think of, first of all, Judaism, of course, is not an ancient term. It doesn't exist in biblical Israel.
Right.
They didn't call themselves Jews. They called themselves the tribes of Israel.
Well, even before that, Ivri.
Well, Abraham, there's no Jews. There's no nation.
Right, but
there's Hebrew, a small clan.
The Hebrew is a wonderful word for boundary crosser. So that's not even a term that adapts.
If that's the true etymology.
Okay.
It's a suggested etymology because Abraham crossed the river. But often names are retrofit, meaning is retrofit in history, in the stories that we tell ourselves.
Okay, so so that I diverted you. So about the Israelites.
Yeah. So once you have a people, they call themselves the Israelites, and they have this practice, whether you want to look at it through the eyes of Orthodox Judaism or modern history of how that process developed. At some point, however you want to understand it, there's this Torah, there are these laws, and the biblical Israelites have this religion. It's always sort of, not always, but except for a very few times where it seems to be moving nicely, it's always in tension with the other cultures around it. The prophets are always screaming, you're acculturating too much, you're assimilating too much, we're not purely practicing our faith, we're not purely carrying our practices. And it's a living, breathing practice based on this, with this book somewhere at the center of it. In the Second Temple period, the northern group of Israelites who continued to call themselves Israelites never returns after destruction. And it's only the group from the area called, in the Bible, called Yehuda, comes back. And they are the surviving part of the nation, let's say a fifth of the nation maybe, based on population, congregates in this area called Yehuda. So the word Jew is a anglicized version of Yehudi, of Judean.
So you're talking about like 2700 BCE to down to 2000, and down to the beginning of the first millennium?
No, not 26. You're talking about, when do they come back? Much later. You're talking about, let's say if we roughly put Abraham in like 1800 BCE, mm-hmm. And let's say we very roughly put leaving Egypt in 1314. If there's a historical event there, is debated. I assume there was, but but there's no historical evidence outside the Bible. Fine. Once you get to around 1000 BCE, you have clear historical evidence in the next couple of centuries of Judean kings and Israelite kings, because the kingdom splits, and their interactions with the other cultures, and we have clear evidence of these people, who we our forefathers. The destruction of their kingdom in roughly 586 BCE leads to the exile in Babylon, in Babel. Mm-hmm. And then, in let's say the 530s, after the Persians overthrow the Babylonians, the Judeans are allowed to return home, and they create a new...
So about 2,500 years ago from now.
Nahum.
Okay.
So oh, yeah, I misunderstood you. Right.
No, I said it wrong. So about 500 BC. Yeah, you know, I misspoke.
You said, right, you meant ago, and you... Okay, yeah. So I heard right, but yeah. I was listening to what you said, not what you meant, basically. So,
you know, we can't always be doing telepathy here. You have to go with the words
I'm
at
trying.
Some point.
Yeah. I thought that's what the headsets were for. They were supposed to help
well,
with.
You don't have these.
That's true. Yours are better. Right, so now you have this culture. And this culture evolves in a very odd way of Judea, because most of the people who think of themselves as Judean don't live in Judea. So that the first temple, the Bible period, the Jews who live somehow with this, with the cultic sacrificial practice at the heart of their religious rites, which is basically accessible to the entire citizenry of Israelites, even though they don't always avail themselves of that resource. But in the Second Temple period, most Judeans don't move to Judea. So most Jews live very far away.
Right, and you're talking about the cultic practice as being coming to the temple for the three pilgrimage mm-hmm. holidays and sacrificing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as that becomes less, and you need the Jews of the exile begin to form identity, cultural bonding systems, and even rituals and practices that begin to create something called Judaism. And in fact, there's a rising group of, certainly during the Persian period, the rabbis remember the name of this group as Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, 120 scholars. And whether that's 120 over time, or there were always 120 sitting at a council and they would just replace them. It's not so clear because we have very little written history from that period. But a lot of they're sort of wrestling with, how do we get this community of Judeans thriving with a strong, intact Jewish identity in such a way that it's also shared with our brothers and sisters who live out of the homeland, who never return, who for business or family or whatever, live in the far-flung regions of not only Babylonia, but they're going to now go, after the conquest of Alexander, they're going to fill wherever the Greeks have conquered. After the Roman conquest, they're going to move out to wherever the Romans have conquered.
Right.
And so what you're going to have is a much more democratized religion. And at this point, we can call it, I think, Judaism or Rabbinic Judaism.
But this is still while the temple stands.
Second Temple. Mm-hmm. While the Second Temple is standing from the Persian period to the Roman period, you have the introduction of blessings and some sort of organization of spoken prayer. You have Kiddush, Havdalah. You have the entry of new holidays into practice, notably Purim and Hanukkah. And you have this evolving, creative, sort of adaptive, culturally evolving set of practices called Judaism. There's a conflict over it. We talked about Hanukkah, where many Jews want off that merry-go-round and they want to Hellenize and become Greek in the Greek period. And you have a good chunk who say, no, we want to retain our culture. And then after the threat of Hellenism fails, you have this sort of divergent approaches to, you have these divergent approaches to what it is to be Jewish, and you have the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I don't want to get too caught up in the in the details, but what Judaism eventually evolves to, and then after the destruction of the temple, is this group of interpretive, creative, dynamic, rabbinic personas who, through the ebb and flow of their creativity and responding to what people do, you have this very now evolved rabbinic Judaism. That's essentially...
But this is post the destruction of the Second Temple?
After the destruction of the Second Temple, you have something that you can really now legitimately call rabbinic Judaism. It begins to be articulated in such a way, this new practice, this new religious way of what were the Israelites, who now call themselves the Jews, has changed so much that it's so adapted, it's so creative, it's so academized, it's so self-reflective, it's been discussed and analyzed and categorized because of the Greek influence, that it's no longer, you can no longer expect people to know it by heart. You can no longer expect Jews to read the written Torah and then know what Judaism is. And so after the destruction of the temple, you have the first writings that become called the oral law. We have the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah that, according to Jewish tradition, was given on Sinai. And this corpus, this ism, this movement, this practice, this culture, has become so complex. It has metamorphosized, it has evolved into this thing that it can no longer simply be an unspoken cultural understanding of the masses. You need scholars to write it down and record it. Right. That's where rabbinic Judaism comes from.
Right, and so what and then out of that is the inside the written, the Gemara, the Talmud, is the working out of the laws as written in the Torah. I mean, there's a lot more. There's a lot of stories, and but in the sense of what I was talking about at the beginning about the merry-go-round.
Yeah.
And the formalization, which I react to when it feels calcified. Is this where you'd say that this type of formalization of law is actually happening, or was it?
I would argue that the beginning happened back while there was a temple, with the beginning of creating blessings. Once you have blessings, you have to know how to say the blessing. It starts very small, and then it snowballs. This process of formalization to create an international Jewish culture, something that can cross borders, which ends up with the destruction of the temple being, now we have something that's portable. Once Jerusalem is destroyed and the cult center is gone, well, it's a good thing we've been creating this democratized individual or communal practice system of Judaism, because now when we're kicked out of our homeland, we can still do it.
Right.
And so there becomes this effort of the scholars of, well, what is it exactly? How do we hold on to it? How do we quantify it and qualify it and categorize it and identify it so that you have this fixing? And as time goes on, the questions... It's funny, when somebody asks a halachic question, or forget halacha, a legal question, does the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution refer to homeowners in the United States owning AR-15s,
nah,
or semi-automatic assault rifles? Is there an answer to that question? Well, there's a lot of answers to that question, and then law becomes the decision
when, by the legal authority.
Of the legal authorities. And so what you have is, over a time, what legal precedent becomes is what was, in the past, an interesting open question, over time becomes a filled-in question. Now, you're always going to have new questions. But after a certain amount of time, you're going to have this body of law.
Wait, I'm going to interject here.
Go ahead.
So, you know, another time we'll speak specifically to dualism and dialecticism, the, like, the more... you know, this side, that side versus multiple perspectives, and we've touched on that. But, you know, when I consider the idea of what it would be to have been a fly on the wall during these conversations when the oral Torah was being written down, that there is, and in the writing, there's multiple perspectives and arguments, often more than two, about holding different positions and ideas and conveying different meanings and all that. And that there is a decision, you know, I fear the minor decision or a major decision, that when it's still oral, there's something more, still more possible with change, it seemed, even, you know, but...
Every choice of medium is a choice of culture. I am sure that when Homer wrote down the Iliad and the Odyssey, that was extremely controversial and something culturally was lost. The fact that there were bards in Greece who had all this stuff in their head and were unique, special people, and when they wandered into your town and could sing you the story of the Iliad, I mean, what that meant to a city or a town. And with the creation of writing and the writing of this stuff down, that was gone. So the skills were gone. The cultural touchstone was gone. People's attent. So you're always trading at every step of the way. And to metaphor, you know, to on a microcosmic level, every childhood step of development is a loss. When we watch our kids go from 3 to 4 and 4 to 5 and we watch what they achieve, we also miss those earlier stages that were so cute before they had achieved that step of development.
Right. Well, I hear with that. So now we're a couple thousand years after that.
We are a couple thousand years after that.
And, you know, speaking to someone today who was saying that no matter what, even someone inside that merry-go-round, you know, inside...
Okay, I don't think there are people on the merry-go-round and off the merry-go-round. That's not my operating metaphor. My operating metaphor is we're all in a river, and some people ride the rapids, and some people are in the slow. Everyone rides the river where they're comfortable.
Some are sunbathing on the
yeah, bank. Okay. So some are sunbathing, and some of the people who are sunbathing don't get back in the river because they don't like it. Mm-hmm. But if you're moving down the river, then you're part of it. Let me just... What happens is this rabbis leading the process breaks down in the modern era. Over the last 300 years, what is Judaism is an interesting question. But the simplest way to answer, there's different ways to define what it means, Judaism. And is this inside? Is this outside? Let's define Judaism for the moment, for the sake of this conversation, as the unique practices of the Jews. The ways Jews behave, not necessarily the things that are uniquely Jewish behaviors, things that Jews do that are different than other peoples.
Such as practicing Shabbat.
Definitely.
The way we practice
Shabbat. The way we practice Shabbat is somewhat different than all the other cultures, even if other cultures have Shabbat. Now, there's all kinds of ways that Jews do things. I think the vast majority of Jews who do Jewish things do not consider halakha as a binding, controlling factor of how they will act and express their Judaism.
Right, that's still my natural experience and approach is through a more personal relationship with the idea than right. It is through anything written or decided.
Using this definition, that's as much to look at Judaism as this great whole now, the way Jews do things Jewishly to express their traditional Jewish cultural whatever, the practices and beliefs of the Jews, there's a lot of them. The rabbis don't run it anymore. And as a matter of fact, the people who are devoted to adhering to the halakha, it's as written down in those forms, and I am one of those people, we're in the minority. So for people in Orthodoxy or out of Orthodoxy, if we look at Judaism as the practices of the Jews, to think of Orthodox Judaism as, well, that's true Judaism. Well, not in 2015, it's not.
Well, so there's something that in Rav Cook's introduction to...
Do you get what I'm saying about it?
Yeah, I want to respond to it.
So when you say the merry-go-round, who is, in your metaphor, who's the merry-go-round?
So in fitting with yours is be the minority, but it's still...
No. So you're talking about Orthodoxy.
Well, I'm talking about the community that says halacha is the basis and it's fixed.
Okay, but what about the community that says halacha isn't the basis and can't be fixed?
Well, I know about that community because I'm in... I'm the fish in the water that swims in that part of the river.
Right. So now what? So now what's the question? Why are you worried about jumping on? You're worried about how the people who are spinning.
I'll step back and say instead of about what I'm worried about that community or this community, I'm concerned about the fragmentation between the communities. And, you know, something that...
Well, so am I. But I don't think the way to fix it is to look for a universal Judaism. There is no Catholic Judaism. That's what Catholicism is,
right? How do you say Pope in Hebrew?
Apifior. You want an Apifior? I mean, that's what the Council of Churchmen at Nicaea did when Constantine said the whole Roman Empire has to be Christian. There were so many different ways to be Christian at that point because it was not an organized religion that he set up the Council of Churchmen in Nicaea. Or I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. And they said, this is going to be, these are the beliefs, these are the practices, and that became the Catholic Church, the universal Christian Church. And guess what? Hasn't really worked.
Right.
Right? Because there's no such thing. You can never have. The pilgrims came to what we call now the United States. They came to North America, and they said, we're going to create these idyllic, self-contained communities based on inherent ideologies. And if you're in, you're in. And if you're out, you're out. And that way we can have a community based on the pure expression. Oh, we need a blacksmith. Any of you Puritans know how to be? No, all right, so we have to bring a blacksmith. Okay. Well, we're going to need a cow herder. Anyone here know? No. All right, we'll have to bring a few people outside. But really, the integrity of the community, then we're going to found a new nation in the new world based on... Calvinism, and that will survive, and we will have a Calvinist country. How well did that work out? All of these attempts, all of these visions of creating a future where everyone's the same, that don't embrace the beauty of the diversity, are going to fail.
So I want to go probe deeper here.
Go ahead.
In reading the introduction to the Rav Cook book that you lent me, let's see, the lights of penitence, lights of holiness, moral principles, and so forth, that, I mean, he was apparently judged negatively for really embracing the secular Zionists,
mm-hmm.
and he's religious, fully halachic, but really seeing the value that this community of secular Jews was bringing to Judaism,
mm-hmm.
and he was apparently. Wanting to convey the danger of really ostracizing or even totally separating the religious Jews, separating from them. And he also saw that there was something in focusing on nationhood as the entire project for the Jews, for that the secular Jews were focused on, was missing the connection with God and I don't know if the English term for what he was getting at was like these of morality, of some pure or truthful morality, so that he was seeing, like, so I really appreciate seeing that, okay, both camps, there's
well,
something.
Well, he saw it as three streams in the river. The way to paraphrase and beat his language to death, but he felt that the religious represent one orthodoxy, he called it, represents one aspect of this, of the nation reconstituting itself. He felt that the nationalists, sort of more the political right, which in his time was led by Jabotinsky, who were saying it's the Jews that have to reconstitute at the expense. We don't have to work with anybody. We don't have to cooperate. We have to self-build our identity. And then you had the other group at his time, which were the socialist Zionists, who saw Zionism as a Jewish expression of a universal movement to create social justice and universal brotherhood, enlightenment values, humanist values. And he said, we're all contributing together to bring life back to the people in their land. And since all of us are contributing, we should all be listening to the voices of each other. We're all going to help each other. Because I'm saying something that you may not realize. And your movement may lead to excess if it's not listening to the other two. So this sort of, not balance of power, but balance of ideology, is the only way to build a healthy national culture. And I would argue that in a democracy, that sort of happens willy-nilly, that the different voices, at least ideally in a democracy, the different voices sort of even each other out. And you may not have individuals as open-minded as Rav Kook, but on the whole, that process happens naturally.
Right, ideally. And I mean, even like to the extent it's happened in the modern West, in, you know, with all the problems that we have, and then also here in Israeli society, where we're seeing even with events in the past couple weeks,
the other piece, though,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's excessive. What we've seen in the past few weeks are people of excess who aren't listening to the other groups,
right? Basically, right? Saying this other group is.
You're talking about the setting fire of an Arab home, or the,
yeah, and also this stabbing, the murder, and hospitalization of folks expressing sexual preference.
Now that you know, we could write that off to craziness, but that's the sort of thing you do to feel comfortable when people who you share some ideology with behave in ways that are disgusting. And you have to, what I think is really important to do is to look inwardly and say, is my outlook listening carefully enough to the others? Because this is a sign that we are getting something wrong, that the religious right. are doing something wrong. I don't know who
said that. Right, I actually saw a very heated Facebook conversation with religious Jews today. Some really looking at the multiple rivers, and then others damning, you know, cursing.
I never understand those. I've seen a few, like, well, where were they when so and so was?
But
I don't understand.
But it started. There was some really beautiful,
mm-hmm.
Heartfelt wrestling, saying exactly what you're saying. You know, look, I'm part of this particular river, and then there's an outgrowth of this river that is murderous, and that's really scary to me, and we have to look at this. But then there's, but then someone else says, well, this is a knee-jerk reaction. Someone else says, well, they're still a jerk and knee-jerk. You know, and then there's a few exchanges that are working, even though they're difficult, but like people really expressing. Mm-hmm. And then it goes to the extreme with some people who then people shut off, you know, get off, because then there's real deep name-calling and, you know.
Well, that's a particular problem also of conversations in social media. It's very hard to have a nuanced conversation without voice and body language. And so that sometimes leads, it happens in person also. But the difficulty of having a difficult, nuanced conversation on Facebook is the process is exacerbated by the
sure
by the medium.
Well, now it'll take 5 seconds for a subliminal message for our listeners to actually post comments and questions and subjects for our podcast, and I'll return
as
to the recording.
Nice.
Okay. And it could be a wrestling. It could definitely be
or hurtful. critical,
right?
But it has to always be positive and constructive.
Yeah, right.
I think.
Yeah.
And but there's one caveat. So in other words, Rav Kook definitely doesn't see it as the speedy merry-go-round. He sees it as streams leading to the river, leading to the ocean that is uniting. But he does think that it's what's happening in Israel. It's the Jewish people reconstituting themselves as a nation where Judaism will be defined. And that we will bring with us many of the things we've learned in our journey through the exile, many positives, many developments, many growths, many cultural accomplishments. We're going to continue to wear with pride. But it's Judaism in the diaspora itself can't ultimately contribute to the true renaissance of what Judaism will become. And it will be different.
Wait, that's what he's saying, is that it's the
people in its homeland coming back to life. That's the Americanism. To be an American in American culture happens in America. It doesn't happen outside America. To be Mexican in Mexican culture happens in Mexico. Taco Bell is not Mexican culture. It's an appropriation, and it's probably a misapplication of it's a. You know, what Americans call Chinese food. So, I'm without getting overly critical of that, and is it what is that doing to the culture that it's still? But Chinese culture is from China. You can experience Chinese culture. You can have a museum devoted to it where you can learn about it, express. And Rav Kook would argue that the Jews, as a nation. Our real we are the weirdest nation in the history on earth, with the only story of survival of exile. We are the only one. And so we had this entire exilic culture that kept us going. And in some cases, many people feel has become too fixed, too stuck on legalistic.
You're talking about the exilic culture, or the
what broke down ultimately in the exile? Rabbinic Judaism, halacha-driven Judaism, which broke. It absolutely broke.
But it's not
starting 300 years ago.
Though, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's in
historically. That, it's everyone agrees that halachic Judaism broke, right? Some say, and that's well and good, and some say, and that's the tragedy we're still trying to fix. But everyone notices that the vast majority of the Jews of Europe stopped practicing halachic Judaism. And that problem grew. It grew. It started in the west of Europe. It spread to the east of Europe. By the time the Holocaust destroyed Jewish communities root and branch, halachic practice was already institutionally... It's impossible to believe that all Jews practiced halacha, but communally, that was the standard. Whatever you did, personally, was what you did. But communally, that was Judaism. Starting in Western Europe, you have the growth of Reform, 18th, 19th century. And that's the majority of German Jews, and it spreads out. And in the East, you have the Maskilim, who don't really have a movement.
What does that mean, Maskilim?
You have this movement of Eastern European Jews who are intellectual, traditional, somewhat, to varying degrees, but aren't comfortable creating a new movement and calling it a name.
So they...
The great Yiddish literature, you know, literary minds. Into the 20th century, you know, you have people like, let's say, Isaac Bashevis Singer, who's from that, who a Yiddishist, deeply Jewish, but not halachic.
Right. Well, he's also dealing with... Yeah, I mean, pretty much the Jewish sense of being Jewish that I grew up with.
Right.
I mean, I didn't read his stories until I was an adult, but I totally knew that as my youthful Judaism. Yeah.
That is Judaism. That is part. Judaism is a big, big whole. Hasidim in New Square is part of Judaism. The Reform Jews of Germany is part of Judaism. It's part of this evolution. And what it will become in the future, nobody knows. God knows.
So why?
So then it becomes, if you have something interesting to say, so say it. Contribute it to the conversation. And that's why we have a podcast, right?
Right. Are we getting to the close here?
No. Okay. We got like another 10 minutes. So go ahead.
So it's interesting that, I mean, here I am, I in a way, with my, that I'm, the experience that I'm outside, okay, so I'm in the river in the sense of the Isaac Bashevis Singer Judaism. I'm in the river very much, especially
as a writer. I think you're in the Andrew Turtis stream of the river.
Well, I am, but it,
I don't think Isaac Bashevis Singer
will not be an ism.
I don't think Isaac Bashevis Singer practiced Jinshin Jitsu as a spiritual expression of his inner religious.
You don't think so? Okay. No, I'll go with that.
Maybe I'm wrong.
But, you know, when I'm swimming, I happen to see a lot of other folks. And I'm, you know, where I live in Israel and where I work in Israel, that I'm exposed to much more formalized mm-hmm. and halachic practices of Judaism. And so sometimes I get into the illusion that this is more majority. Is this practice. And I know...
I mean, numerically, that's just not true, right?
Right, but just where kind of my exposure sometimes in Israel, it's like the majority of who's around me.
Right. Well, go ahead.
But also when I'm in a community in America and I'm with a lot of friends who are Jewish and non-Jewish and friends who are practicing spiritually, and then those whose lives are just taken up with social causes and are totally not involved at all with halacha or any formalized Jewish practice, just the bringing the social mm-hmm. justice issues, you know, kind of focused on. So that I do hear strong voices about the social causes, which are if the streams that you're talking about from with Rav Kook identifying, so that would be one stream that's their focus would be on the social causes, social justice, and also including that environmental justice. And then, so not on nation, some on the U.S. nation, but still, I'd say within the context of social environmental justice. And then, you know, as far as religion and connection with God as the Jewish God, you know, a lot outside of that, but still a strong, some of that group would have a lot of focus on spiritual connection, personal spiritual connection development. And then here, often I don't see I hear some talk about personal work, the Midot, working on Musar, but a big focus on nation, and then a bigger focus on the halacha. And
you really don't see in Israel movements that are concerned with social justice?
No, I do see movements. I'm talking about I'm talking about who I brush up against in my day to day. The focus seems to be on nation or halacha.
And part of the problem of Israeli life today is that we tend to live in bubbles, work bubbles, community bubbles, and the more we can break those bubbles and make a more porous, you know, if we can turn it from a series of bubbles to this this interconnecting web, if we can really get that's exactly what Rav Kook was worried about. He was worried we were going to live in bubbles and in our own little echo chambers where we keep talking to ourselves and saying, look how right we are and what's wrong with everybody else. And instead of going, I'm making a good point. Can you hear it? Okay, now you're making a good point. I have to hear it because what you're saying is valid. And that makes me think, I'm not changing. I'm not going to create a vanilla culture where all of us live the same sort of practice because we're making it totally comfortable for everyone at any level. I have my approach. And my approach makes me look in the world in a certain way. And therefore, I will see things that you will miss. Right. Because your approach doesn't look at the world that way. And vice versa. And if I expect you to listen to me because I have insight, then I should expect me to listen to you because you have insight. Right. And that dialogue doesn't happen enough.
Right. And I do feel that limitation of the bubble more here than I do in the U.S., even though they're in conversation about Israel, there's a bubble about Israel right now, you know, mm-hmm. because folks in the social justice movement are, you know, really getting a lot of information from the anti-Israel movement. So mm-hmm. I think, but I'd say otherwise, though, as far as race and racism, as far as economic justice, as far as Black Lives Matter, and, you know, the countless environmental issues, I'd say that there's a lot of conversation between a lot of people I know that are in different levels of society and different groups. In Israel, the bubble's really, it's this studying with you and having the podcast has helped me actually connect a little bit more with some of the other bubbles. But there's, I think it's, it starts with intention, that there's a lot of people who are, okay, this is my focus and this is what's right, and outside of that it's wrong. And I think it's taking something big to actually shift that. And I know that's something that Deborah Haberman was really working on, is to say, what's our common vision? You know, the religious, the nationalists, and the folks on social justice, what do we have in common? And let's pull this in with art and theater and communication and really revitalize this project here. And Judaism, I mean, it's such a big vision, but we need something big enough that's going to unite.
Mm-hmm. And that takes time. That takes time, and it takes living together in shared space with shared destiny, with shared fate, where by living together and sharing space and issues and economy and election and security, that ultimately, because we have to live together, because we have to come to a modus vivendi, therefore we will culturally group together. And I don't know if it's 100 years from now, 200 years from now, that I assume there won't be as much Ashkenazi, Sephardi. There will be people doing things differently, but the differences will be different. In the Middle Ages, you had the Karaites and the Rabbinites. In the Second Temple, you had the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So I think we're going to have different streams, but it's not going to be Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist. By the way, I think it's important that when you talk about Judaism, in my definition, I'm including Reconstructionism, which explicitly says God and spirituality is not necessarily part of what Judaism is. Right?
I know I've read that at some point.
But you mentioned earlier that, you know, right, however your spiritual life and God, but as right, opposed to, you can be an atheist. And
well, I know a rabbi who, in California, who Keilah Community Synagogue, Rabbi David, who doesn't believe in God, and totally is there for everyone in his community who does.
Now that's an interesting question. Can you be? Is it valid to be an Orthodox, Conservative, or Reform rabbi who doesn't believe in God and say that you're a representative of that movement? You can absolutely be a Reconstructionist rabbi.
Well, it's a renewal. It's a renewal congregation.
And I think renewal also.
But what's amazing to me of the the humility in being able to serve a community that mostly has people believing in mm-hmm. some kind of divinity.
But that's how broad I think the definition is. I'm just more skeptical than you are because I think in terms... I think through Rav Kook's prism, I'm more skeptical what those exilic contributions ultimately are going to make at this point, now that we're in a renaissance here.
I hear that. I think having been kind of awakened to social justice in the U.S. and been involved with composting and sharing in taking, like, reducing the amount of trash, something as simple as that, reducing the amount of trash with my African-American neighbors and my Jewish neighbors who don't affiliate, and my Chinese-American neighbors, and mm-hmm. like folks from all over the world and on every economic class within one block, but people separating their trash and, like, having this real amazing follow through with that feeling barriers break down, even talking about racial profiling by the police with my African American neighbors, and feeling like, okay, there's so much difference. We're mm-hmm. we're the only connection we have is we're American, we're human, mm-hmm. and here in Israel, we're so many of the communities that I'm in touch with are Jewish, and how much lack of working together and alignment.
So the question becomes a tension between universality and particularism, which is something Rav Kook struggled with.
Right.
And the way he ended up resolving it was, he said, and I'll put it in my own language, you can do tremendous things and be a wonderful Kiddush Hashem. A Jew can do things that he can't do here and satisfy the love of all of God's creation in ways that you can't do working in a Jewish state, because you're not connecting in the same way. But what our goal is to create a nation that's an Or LeGoyim, not individuals.
An Or LeGoyim?
An Or, a light to the nations.
Ah, not they're saying an English word.
Okay. No, Or LeGoyim. Not individuals who are sanctifying God's name by their example, but a people who, as a group, are an emblem of how people can live together based on righteousness and justice in such a way that they become, you know, the city on the hill to steal a...
Okay, so there's more to talk about. There is the prism which will survive. The one ism that we want is to recognize the difference and the light each person's bringing. Thank you all for listening to our podcast, One Way Or...
I can't let you go. That was a great... that was an awesome callback.
Oh, thanks. It's great co-hosting with you, Michael. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Please give the addresses for connection.
At One Way Or podcast on Twitter and Facebook.
OneWayOr.com, our website.
Mm-hmm. Love to hear from you.
Yeah, we would. And music is brought to you by Saul K., Jewish Blues Pioneer.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.